Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome again to another edition of ESI Bytes. My name's Carl Shinneman. I'm Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Jernov. And today we've got a really neat show. We're looking at one of the most important cases in the electronic discovery world today, Qualcomm. And the goal of ESI Bytes has always been, it still remains, to cover topics of importance for e-discovery and electronic records management with speakers who speak all over the country at big conferences, but to offer this at a price that everyone can afford, which is free, at a time when maybe you're interested in listening to the information presented. So we have a really excellent speaker here, Michael Lackey from the Am Law 100 law firm, Mayer Brown. Mike has focused on civil and criminal litigation and electronic discovery. He represents major companies and individuals in state and federal proceedings, including multi-district and class action litigation, government contract disputes, and appeals. He's a nationally recognized for his knowledge of electronic discovery issues. In fact, he's a member of the board of advisors to the Georgetown University Law School Advanced E-Discovery Institute. He co-chairs Mayer Brown's electronic discovery and records management practice, and he also chairs the firm's automated practice support group. In addition, he's also an award-winning adjunct professor of advanced appellate advocacy at George Washington University Law School. And if that wasn't enough, he's also the first guest at ESI Bytes who graduated from the Top Gun School. We're going to have Tom Cruise on at some point. But anyway, thanks for joining us, Mike. Appreciate having you on the show here.
Yeah, my pleasure, Carl. Great to join you.
Well, I always like to ask everyone, and you know, the first question is, how did you first become interested in electronic discovery?
Sure. My practice early on focused on large antitrust cases, and started back in the paper world about 15 or so years ago. And as we started moving into electronic media, and it was becoming a bigger and bigger part of the antitrust cases, I figured I better learn about this. And I've always been, my undergraduate was at MIT. I was an engineer in my first life, and I've always been interested in technology. And so I found it kind of interesting. And, one thing led to another. The more I learned about it, then folks within the law firm would call me and ask me about it. And then I started going to a few conferences and just kind of speaking up a bit. And then they started asking me to speak at some of these conferences. And just one thing led to another, and now here I am. But it's a fascinating topic. The other part I love about it is that it's really the Wild West, and that the case law, as we're going to talk about today, is just, it's developing. It's kind of fun to get in on the ground floor of an area of substantive law that's really just exploding and is critical to every piece of litigation you're involved in.
Yeah, I remember being back at a conference, I think in about 2005, and the law firm sponsoring it proclaimed their expertise because they'd handled two large cases. and that was an off-the-cuff remark to me and a partner at that firm, but it really is the Wild West and developing. So let's jump right into this. First of all, while I know Qualcomm broke well over a year ago, it has had such tremendous implications for the electronic discovery field that I really wanted to have a podcast giving an overview of how it's shifted the role and obligations of outside counsel. And, that can be seen now with a little bit of time behind us. So can you start first by giving us an overview of the case?
Sure, I'd be happy to. The litigation was Qualcomm versus Broadcom Corp., and it hit the news again recently because they finally settled the suit all in all. But it's a patent dispute, intellectual property dispute between two high-tech companies. It was pending out in the Southern District of California. And during the course of discovery, as often happens, folks found out things late. There was some late-breaking information that came in, and how counsel handled it and how they got in that situation has kind of led to the ultimate opinions. But to give you a little bit more background on the case, it was a patent infringement case. It involved video compression technology. A critical issue in the case was whether or not Qualcomm was a member of the standard setting body, this H.264 standard setting body. If you are a member of the standard setting body, then as part of being, and standard settings are deciding how the new technologies are going to be rolled out broadly. I'm not an IP lawyer, so I'm going to speak in layperson's terms here, but if you do participate in the standard setting and deciding which technologies are going to be going forward, part of that is you have to be able to offer your technologies either free or on commercially reasonable rates, things like that. Qualcomm claimed that it was not a part of the standard setting body. And when the standards came out and the standards required some use of some Qualcomm patents, they then brought a patent infringement case. So whether or not Qualcomm was a member of the standard setting body was central to the litigation. And so as they throughout the litigation, that was a key issue, and they kept saying, no, we were not involved in the standard setting litigation and that we weren't really that aware of what was going on. And as they, and obviously because it was so central to this, there were document requests from Broadcom asking specifically whether or not Qualcomm participated in this body and whether or not they received documents or gave documents to the body. And they said no throughout. Then what happened is, as you start to get closer and closer to litigation, some of the lawyers are talking to the witnesses a second and third time, and they look at the hard drive of a particular witness, and they find some emails that reflect that they were sent from this service list, the Advanced Video Coding and Ad Hoc Group, which became the famed AVC underlined CE emails. And although they determined this late in the litigation, literally a trial as you're prepping the witnesses before they go and take the stand, this information came up. The attorneys for Qualcomm did not disclose it to the court initially, and indeed put the individual witness who had the emails on the server on the stand and asked a very careful kind of question that basically said, did you ever read any emails from the mailing list? And of course, you know, the antennae from the other counsel, from Broadcom's counsel, went up at that point, because that's a very carefully constructed question. They asked whether or not they received any emails, and at that point, the particular witness, VG, said yes, and obviously created kind of a big firestorm there, where they went back and initially they had found about, I guess it was 21 emails, and Qualcomm goes ahead and produces those 21 emails that have that mailing list address on it, and then it just all goes crazy from there. Litigation continues on. Broadcom prevails. The court afterwards, because of this, court finds that there are some discovery, irregularities, I'll say, at this stage, and they ordered them to go back and look for more emails. Ultimately, Qualcomm finds something like 46,000 responsive documents and 300,000 pages of documents that would have otherwise been responsive to this listserv, and produces them all. And a lot of these documents were from some of these witnesses who had testified. So at this point, the court's, you know, a little disturbed about how discovery's gone forward. And in the fall of 07, has a hearing and issues an order. And the court found that by clear and convincing evidence that Qualcomm's counsel had participated in, and this is the court's language, an organized program of litigation misconduct and concealment throughout discovery, trial, and post-trial. Obviously, a big, big deal. Now, that was from the magistrate judge. It then goes up to the district court judge, Judge Major, and in a January 08 opinion, goes ahead and affirms that and says the sanctions attorneys, they also sanctioned some attorneys and Qualcomm, individual attorneys and Qualcomm, and again, in the kind of quote you never want to read about yourself. Said the sanctioned attorneys assisted Qualcomm in committing this incredible discovery violation by intentionally hiding or recklessly ignoring relevant documents, ignoring or rejecting numerous warning signs that Qualcomm's document search was inadequate, and blindly accepting Qualcomm's unsupported assurances that its document search was adequate. And so the court goes ahead and sanctions the company and the attorneys. The sanction was for $8.5 million, which was essentially all of Broadcom's attorneys' fees and their costs. Six Qualcomm outside counsel were ordered to report themselves to the California State Bar, and five in-house attorneys and those six Qualcomm outside attorneys were ordered to participate in a program to basically help them, remind them, and to instruct them on their discovery obligations.
So of course, this hit headlines all over the country.
Oh, yeah. Qualcomm's in-house, you probably remember, Qualcomm's in-house counsel, general counsel, resigned around the same time. I don't know whether they officially linked the two, but it was around the same time. So And there, as you might imagine at this stage, Carl, there's enormous tension between the company and the outside counsel. Fingers are starting to point both ways. The outside counsel say, you know, we really couldn't defend ourselves because of attorney-client privilege issues. And now that, you know, the sanction motions and findings have been made, we need to do that. And so the court goes ahead and enters an order that allows outside counsel to get discovery and to defend themselves in litigation. Subsequently, this judgment, the sanctions and the awards are affirmed in December of this last year, 2008. Since then, a lot of litigation going back and forth between the law firms and Qualcomm, and ultimately this entire discovery dispute gets settled and put to bed, and nothing more ever comes out of it. So, you know, a very cautionary tale that got everyone's attention when general counsels resign, when outside counsel, it's one of the first cases that I recall where outside counsel and in-house counsel were referred to bars for sanctionable conduct, and that really got everyone's attention. Outside lawyers and in-house counsel, it really became a high-profile issue for everyone.
Yeah, these were sophisticated parties, and the law firm involved was a very sophisticated firm, so it was it struck at the gut of e-discovery. Well, let's talk about the implications of this case and the delegation of tasks mm-hmm. in a typical electronic discovery project. You know, how does the Qualcomm decision impact the in-house attorney?
Well, it creates a tension. I think it's been clear, and we'll probably talk a little bit about this later since Zubelake, that the in-house lawyer and the outhouse lawyer and the outside lawyer, outhouse lawyer, I love that, both have responsibilities to make sure that the discovery and the responses are adequate and accurate. And what I think you're seeing here is, in this case, it appears as though the outside counsel were relying significantly on the in-house lawyers to do a lot of the discovery work. And that's not uncommon in big cases. And the Qualcomm litigation also had an additional complexity in that you had two law firms, essentially one law firm, outside law firm, doing the discovery work, and another outside law firm basically doing the trial work. And so you have pieces of information in all sorts of different pockets, and you have lawyers making representations to the court based on things they have heard, but not things that either they or their own associates or their own attorneys have personally verified or were personally involved. You have attorneys quoting from briefs that were filed earlier by other lawyers with factual representations that later turned out to be false. And so the way it has changed, and I saw this immediately after the decision, is that law firms are basically the ones who have to make the 26G representations, or the ones who have to stand up in court and make representations, are demanding, and rightfully so, candidly, more direct involvement to make absolutely certain that the statements they are making to the court in those documents are accurate. So you're seeing less reliance on just outside or, you know, another outside lawyer or in-house counsel when they tell you something. It's the trust, but also verify, if you will, kind of going back to a government term a few years ago.
It's almost crying out for project management, which is the topic of another podcast I think I'm going to do tonight with Brett Burney.
No.
You're an engineer, so you understand this all too well. You got to rely on your team what's going on.
Absolutely right. And one thing that came out in the Qualcomm opinion is that when you start to see answers or things that pop up that don't seem quite right, you really can't bury your head in the sand. You need to follow up on those particular issues and run them to ground and make sure they make sense. And that was one of the things that the court kind of looked at. They said, look, there were enough red flags here that you really should have followed up and investigated before you made these representations to the court. I think you're absolutely right. If you've got a great project management team in place and you've got adequate checks and balances, and when something comes up, the outside law firm or whomever is going to be making the representations follows up and really runs them to ground to make sure that all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed, I think you're going to be fine. I don't think Qualcomm stands for the proposition that there's no role for in-house counsel in the discovery process. To the contrary, I think every opinion has consistently said, starting with Zubelake, that there is an important role for in-house counsel in the discovery process. But there's going to have to be a very close relationship between the two, And when outside counsel has questions, they need to ask them. That's their ethical obligation. That's their legal obligation. They're going to have to make representations. And I think it's important for in-house counsel to be sensitive to that responsibility of the outside counsel. It's not that we don't trust you. It's that we're going to have to stand up in front of the court and make absolutely certain. And that's a new kind of twist, I think. And as long as in-house counsel understand that, and that when we're asking you those questions, again, it's not that we don't trust you. It's that in light of decisions like Qualcomm and the more recent kind of Brake Gillespie and other things like this, or when you're asking the other law firm, that's why we're doing it. It's our obligation. And that's a very important change, I think, the emphasis on this trust but verify aspect of
auditors have lived this way for years, and you know, and that's why they follow strict audit programs to dot their I's and cross their T's. So but anyway, it's interesting. In-house count I love your outhouse counsel thing that keeps slipping. I'm doing an ACCA CLE in the fall, and it's managing outside counsel. I'm going to have to remember. But anyway, now the business people play a role in this too, and how are they impacted by Qualcomm?
Well, I think that the key point again is that the business folks are going to be an integral part of this, because they're going to be the ones who are going to help you find the data sources and help you find the custodians. But I think what you're going to see, so they're absolutely critical to any project and any electronic discovery assignment. But the difference is going to be when your outside counsel is asking you those more probing questions as a business person, I think being aware of why they're doing it. Once again, it's not that we don't trust you. I think this heightened sensitivity on both sides, for the outside law firms to know that, look, I really do need to follow up on this, and even if it's going to annoy your inside counsel, it's something you have to do. I mean, you just cannot accept a representation blindly that you're kind of saying, I'm not sure I fully understand this, or it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. You must follow up, and whether that's with the lawyers or with the business people, I think it's pretty clear post-Qualcomm that's your obligation.
And, you know, you've also got other vendors involved here. You've got staffing companies and the technology companies. Are they impacted?
Yeah, I think in the exact same way. It's just not acceptable anymore. If you hear something for the vendor or something just doesn't make sense for you, or to you, that you follow up with them and find out exactly what's going on. If they're out doing the collection and they come back with something that sounds a little squirrely, like, well, we only found so many documents for so-and-so, and, well, did you ask around and find out? Yeah, we did. I just wouldn't accept that. If it's something that seems wrong to you, that doesn't make a lot of sense, you need to get personally involved at that stage. If you're going to be the one who's signing those 26G under the federal rules certification that your discovery is full and complete as of the time you do it, or if you're going to stand up in court and defend what's happening. So it's just not enough these days. We all have different roles in the ESI and in the electronic production, but the outside counsel really needs to be riding herd on this, and they need to make sure that everything is making sense to them.
Okay, and we've referred to Zuba Lake a few times, and that first raised the issue of responsibility and oversight for the process in the e-discovery setting. Tell us a little bit more about Zuba Lake.
Yeah, I think, you know, Zuba Lake, Judge Scheinlein up in the Southern District of New York handled that case and really started putting ESI on the map in my mind. And I saw her speak a couple times early on and really sensitized a lot of us to the different issues.
She's done podcasts here. She's, you know, someone I'm friendly with. I bottled some wine based on the Zuba Lake opinion called 4C that she's been very fond of. It ties in the case law. We'll talk about that after the show, though.
Yeah, no, she's absolutely fabulous and obviously very knowledgeable in this area. Well, I think to me the biggest takeaway from Zuba Lake is it really emphasized to me the responsibilities on the litigation hold process and the different roles of inside counsel and outside counsel again. And it made absolutely certain that you can't just send out that litigation hold notice and then do nothing. You've got to follow up and make sure that people are doing what they're supposed to be doing and that you have adequate controls in place. And so it was in a more specific area, in my view. In that particular case, there were issues about the preservation of documents in the litigation. And ultimately, as you may recall, Zubelik 1, it was an employment discrimination case. And Judge Shendlin kind of laid out the law in this area and carefully delineated the different roles and responsibilities of inside counsel and outside counsel. And I think a lot of the case law since then is kind of built on that. It's modified it, trimmed it back in some areas, but I think the underlying premise there about the roles and responsibilities of inside and outside counsel is just as true today as it was when she authored those opinions.
Okay, and you know, if we're looking at this whole impact of this case, you know, what has happened to the traditional and trusted role of your counselor at a law firm? Is my grandfather's law firm dead? You know, has that been eroded away?
Well, that's a great question. Kind of like your grandfather's Oldsmobile. I don't know what happened to them.
That's
They're
been
gone,
eroded
right?
away too. Yeah.
Yeah, I think they are dead. I don't believe so. I think the only difference, as I say, you're going to see is, and if everyone understands what's driving it, you're going to see a more probing questions from your outside law firms. In the old days, you've been working with particular in-house attorneys or business people for years and years and years, and they told you something, you took it to the bank, unless it just, you know, completely didn't seem right. And I think you're just going to see a lot more probing in those particular areas. The other part, I don't know if you meant it this way, but another way you can kind of pick up on it is lawyers have got to be technologically savvy. It's very clear from some of the New York State ethics opinions that keeping up with technology is an important part of being a competent lawyer these days. And so I remember when I first started practicing law, there were several of the more senior partners who didn't have computers at all and didn't have email accounts. And that is just not acceptable these days. You can't walk into court and say, well, I just don't know. You know, this is technology. I'm a lawyer. I don't get this. The judges have been absolutely clear that that is not an accepted response, that I think both ethically and legally, as an attorney practicing these days, you have to be up to speed on the ESI issues and on the law in this area and on the technology. It's just not going to be adequate if someone says, well, we didn't capture all the metadata and we just produced TIFFs and you have no idea what they're talking about, you really can't serve your clients in this day and age.
Boy, you want to introduce the show we're doing tomorrow with Judge Grimm and on search and retrieval tips from like 10,000 feet. I think that's going to be something we're going to talk about a bit. Yeah,
yeah. No, he's fabulous. Another Georgetown board member. He and I have done a couple of presentations together. But absolutely fabulous. There are quite a few judges out there who are pushing the envelope, thinking very thoughtfully about it, and he's obviously one of the leaders.
Mm-hmm. Any other tips for counsel in this world of responsibility that they have now?
Well, I think the key point is just keeping your eyes open and looking for these red flags and following up, just like you would have done in a substantive investigation in an antitrust case, which is what the majority of my cases have been, large antitrust cases. You run these kind of issues to ground. Now in the ESI, think about it as an internal investigation, as I'm trying to find where the documents are, just like you're trying to find out whether an agreement was reached between competitors. And run it to ground, conduct it exactly like that, and document. A very important part is that you keep track of what you do, why you do it, and because later down the road, you're probably, if it's a civil case, going to have to make representations to the other side, either in a deposition or in a document. You may have to talk to the court about what you did and why. None of these processes, by the way, are ever perfect, and the standard is not perfection, it's reasonableness. But part of reasonableness is being able to identify what decisions you made and why you made them, and whether or not, based on what you knew at that time, that was a reasonable approach to take. And so as attorneys, be thinking about that throughout the litigation process and keeping track of what's going on, so that you can explain it later if you have to.
Let's talk briefly about one other case you mentioned, which has been compared to Qualcomm, the Bray Gillespie versus Lexington Insurance. What's your thought, takeaway on that case?
Yeah, you know, that's a case just came out this March, the most recent decision, and it's basically a dispute over production formats. And it kind of goes to the importance of your objections when you're filing it. In this particular case, One side wanted documents in native format. They kind of had boilerplate in their production, in their document production requests, and they were pretty clear that that's what they wanted. Under the federal rules, you can specify the production format you want, and the other side didn't do that. They collected them in with the metadata intact and then TIFFed them out. With there's nothing wrong with that as long as you have an agreement with the other side or you've resolved it and then produced it. But then where they got in trouble, which happens, this is, you know, it's a recurring theme of, about not knowing what you did and how you did it, and then making misrepresentations to court. They claimed that they had received them from the client without the metadata. And that's where they got in trouble. There were misrepresentations made to the courts. Courts do not like that. Realize whenever you're going to be delving into these issues, it's usually going to be in the context of, you know, something has been lost, or you're kind of on the defensive. You're explaining what happened. And if you make misrepresentations at that stage where you're already a little on the defensive, it really puts you behind the eight ball. So at the end of the day, the court found that the attorneys made misrepresentations. They sanctioned an individual attorney and the law firm and imposed you know, a lot of costs to go back and produce these documents in native format. But it kind of goes to something that I think is just a best practice these days in this brave new world of ESI. And when, number one, when you're submitting your document request, absolutely appropriate, you can ask for whatever format you want. But if you're on the receiving end, object to it. If there's not a reason that they need native production in every single kind of document, for example, Word or email, and there seldom is actually a need for that, then object to it. And fight it out. Try to work it out with your opposing counsel if you can, if it's important to you. There are lots of reasons, by the way, probably the subject for another podcast for you, as to why you wouldn't want to produce in native, the vast majority of documents, and why you shouldn't really have to. But in any event, and when you make those representations to courts, you have got to be accurate. This case also has the same thing, Carl. A couple different law firms involved, you know, miscommunication as to who said what to whom. One law firm replaced the other when a partner left the firm and went to another. And so those kinds of miscommunications can really lead to disastrous opinions, and you read them over and over and over again in the e-discovery context.
Boy, I almost think we should have had an EO carrier sponsor this show instead of Juranov, an e-discovery technology vendor, but anyway.
You're probably right about that.
Well, Michael, thank you for sharing some of your insights on these important cases, and I look forward to maybe having you on a few more shows in the future. And I want to thank everyone that's listening to the show. If you want to listen to a complete library of podcasts, you can visit www.esibytes.com. Just remember to come to ESI Bytes to learn about electronic discovery and records management before ESI bites you back, just like in Qualcomm. So anyway, thanks again, and have a nice day.
My pleasure, Carl. Thank you.